Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 215, recorded Monday, August 31st, 2015. Alan Stern, principal investigator for New Horizons. Triangulation is brought to you by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service that is the most sophisticated way for you to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/triangulation to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/triangulation. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With a built-in HD camera and microphone, you can monitor your front door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like being home even when you're not. Right now, get $10 off the Ring Video Doorbell when you go to ring.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology and pick their brains and get to learn. And I love doing this each and every Monday on the network because it's a learning experience for me. And I get to talk to people that I really, really want to talk to. You may recognize this photo. From just a couple of months ago, the guy in the middle. Can you see it, Jason? Hold on a second. Jason's pulling it up for us. This photo went all around the world, and rightly so. Scientists celebrating the arrival, actually the flyby of Pluto by the New Horizons space probe. And right there, arms raised, in what must have been at probably the most exciting moment of your life, Alan Stern, our guest today joining us. He is the principal investigator of New Horizons. Dr. Stern, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you bet, Leo. Happy to be here.
You remember that moment, of course.
I can't remember it at all.
That's got to be a high point, especially because it took so long to get to that point.
Well, it did. You know, New Horizons was a project that really got its start in the late 1980s, and some of us have worked on it ever since then. So it took a lot of persistence, no question.
You were in graduate school in 1989 when you went to JPL. Go ahead.
Indeed. I finished my PhD that year. We began talking to NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. about it, I think it was in May.
So we've done similar. We did, in fact, just at that time, we had just flown by Neptune. And Triton.
That was that summer.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was some precedent for what you wanted to do, but Pluto is way out there. What are the particular challenges of getting a spacecraft that far out?
Well, I would say they fall in two categories. The challenges are partially human challenges and partially technical challenges. The human challenges revolve around the fact that it is very far out, and it's just human nature. It's hard to sell anyone really on these long-term projects. Much quicker return if you fly a mission to Mars or even Jupiter. It doesn't take a decade to get across the solar system, and you have the technical challenges that you need a very reliable spacecraft. In this case, had to be done on a pretty low budget compared to previous outer planet missions. And when you combine the need for reliability with the long flight time and on top of that, a breakthrough level budget, it really presented quite a challenge.
Yeah.
You did it.
Pretty exciting. We're the same age, and it's mind-boggling for me to think of having this year completed something I started in the late 80s. That is a long-term project. And as you point out,
it's like raising a child.
I guess it is, isn't it? Yeah,
we do that. 25 years into it.
Yeah.
But as you point out, it's not human scale in some ways. It's especially for science, it's a difficult thing to propose to people. So tell us what a principal investigator is. What does that mean? You're a PI.
Yeah, well, there are different ways you can think of that. In NASA speak, the PI is the person that leads the project for the agency. So everybody in New Horizons works for me in one respect or another. I'm at the top of the project. You know, a lot of people know the term PI by a different acronym. It's private investigator.
Yeah, right.
That's another actual aspect of doing a big science mission or even a small science project is you're very much like a private investigator in that you're trying to solve some mysteries. In our case, we're trying to understand how small planets came to be, how they were formed, how they evolved, and do that by flying a spacecraft all the way out to one and exploring it.
Yeah.
But the job of the PI is sometimes to be, I say, the principal instigator, the one that keeps everybody moving in the right direction. And ultimately, I'm the person responsible to NASA for the success of the project.
It sounds like an administrative role, but you know, your background, I'm not telling you anything, but for people watching, Dr. Stern's background is, as I mentioned, as a planetary scientist, an engineer, a pilot. You were also a candidate to fly in the shuttle.
All those things.
Yeah.
That's true.
So
yeah.
You're very hands-on. It must be difficult I don't know. Is it to be the administrator of a project this big and not? Don't you want to get it into the controls?
Well, a lot of what I do is technical in the job as PI.
Yeah.
I've been sitting on a lot of technical design meetings, mm-hmm. Engineering reviews, flight operations reviews, things like that. But there is an administrative aspect to it, and I wouldn't have signed up for it if I didn't think that I could carry it out. And you know, from my perspective, I thought it was very important that somebody stand up and lead this project with a passion to really make it happen. Because there have been so many other attempts to get missions to Pluto that had failed for one reason or another. It just came a point in that 25 years, around the year 2000, when I said to myself, This could be my life's work. This could be the most important thing I ever work on, and I'm willing to put in however much time it takes to make it successful. And fortunately, we were able to bring together a spectacular team of people and organizations, really top-notch across the board and dedicated across the board, who also made it their life's work to see it through and to see it through successfully.
Yeah. What was the budget for New Horizons? How much did it cost?
If you add the budgets that we've had for every year so far and include, so that's from the time we started the design, all the way through the rest of the design, building it, getting it tested, then launched, and flying it across the solar system, right through the flyby, and you include the data analysis and the remaining part of the flight that we'll be doing that's associated with the Pluto mission, that comes out to about $723 million.
Nothing. I mean, not nothing, obviously.
It's large by some standards and small by others.
It's an amazing accomplishment for a very, I mean, that's a small budget. Even in NASA numbers, that's a small budget. That's a remarkably frugal.
Well, it's five times less than the Voyager program cost.
Yeah.
Another way to think of it is if you bought Time magazine the week of our flyby to read about New Horizons, you spent more on that one Time magazine than you individually spent as an American taxpayer on New Horizons. That's pretty amazing.
You're famous you're well known at NASA for frugality, for keeping projects on time and on budget. And I think that that's kind of got to be an important part of this mission if we're going to continue to do the stuff that we're doing.
Well, I agree with you. Being able to stick to your word. You know, these projects are complicated. They involve technology development. They involve doing new things that no one's ever done before. So, you know, it's I think it's important that we not hold an unreasonable standard that a project can never overrun at all. But we sure want to be in a world where if it's supposed to be about this big a box, that's how big the box is, not that big.
Right.
Because what happens in the NASA world is when a project overruns, there's no printing press. There's no way to generate more money except to take it from other projects and slow them down or stop them altogether. And that's, that's not a good behavior. And it reduces the amount that we can get done in the space program. So I'm very proud of the fact that New Horizons could do outer planet exploration on a breakthrough small budget. We were above our original budget target, but not very much, and certainly only a tiny amount compared to many missions that get themselves into trouble. So thank you for asking.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I kind of want to applaud you for that. I mean, if it were up to me, NASA would have a 10 times larger budget, but there's a lot of competing projects and a lot of things we have to do, and I'm sure Congress is, figuring out the best it can. Is one of the questions that you get asked when you're trying to raise money for this kind of thing, what's the point? What do we gain? What do we gain by this? I think of the amazing Large Hadron Collider, and it's very difficult for scientists to give you any practical use for this. And yet the money was raised in Europe primarily. We couldn't really get it together to do the superconducting super collider here in the United States. What do you tell people about this mission and missions like this in general? What is our benefit?
Well, I tell them a couple different things. It depends on how the question's asked. But, one of the things I like to point out to people if they're a little skeptical is that these great voyages of exploration are what nations and societies go down in history for.
Yeah.
And I'll challenge them. Sometimes I'll say, who do you know from the 15th century? Yeah. Name some people from the 15th century, and usually the first person they'll name would be Columbus.
Right.
Well, there's an explorer. Who else can you name? Then they'll say Ferdinand and Isabella. And I'll say, well, those are the folks that funded that explorer. Doing the kind of work that NASA does and the kind of missions like New Horizons that go down in history, that develop new knowledge, and you can only do a first exploration of Pluto and the Kuiper Belt once in history. That's the kind of thing that inspires kids to STEM education careers. That's the kind of thing that impresses both friend and foe alike, I think, in foreign countries. And it's certainly the kind of thing that our nation goes down in history for and is known for. It says something about the kind of society that we are, that we're not only about fixing our present-day problems, but that we're striving to be better human beings and to learn more about the world around us.
We're talking to Alan Stern, principal investigator for the amazing New Horizons probe that, as you well remember, just took incredible pictures of Pluto, and we're still getting the pictures. I'm going to ask him a little bit about where New Horizons is now, what's going on now with that data, because there's, I know, much more data that we still have to receive. What's ahead for him and for NASA and for private space versus public space? Because I know you have some opinions on that, Dr. Stern, as well. You're watching Triangulation, our show today brought to you by a company that you may want to get to know in this interesting time. Wealthfront, if you watch the stock market day to day, you probably shouldn't. It's like watching your weight day to day. It's been going up. It's been going down. It's been good. It's been bad. And it's probably a little confounding to somebody who's trying to put money aside for a long-term prospects, retirement, a house, just taking care of your family. Wealthfront really solves this conundrum by making it possible for you to invest intelligently for the long term without worrying about short-term ups and downs. This is the way to do it. Now, of course, you could go to somebody. If there's somebody you really trust, that's great if you really trust them. But traditional advisors charge like 1% to 3% of what you have under management, not to mention transaction fees and other hidden charges. And that's going to whittle away your investment pretty darn quickly. Wealthfront makes it easy for anyone to access world-class long-term investment management, a minimum investment of $500. That's all you could start putting it away right now. And for less than one quarter, for a cost of 0.25% a year, 25 basis points, zero commissions, never any hidden fees. We're talking less than $5 a month to manage $30,000. And that's it. In fact, I'm going to tell you how you can get it for an even better deal in just a second. Wealthfront.com. Go there right now. You can sign up for free. Get a free portfolio. You'll answer some questions so they can get an idea of your long-term strategies, whether you're how risk-averse you are, when you're, you know, what your time frame is. All of this is commission-free. It's done programmatically. Some very sophisticated programs that allow you to do things really that a human can't do very well, like tax loss harvesting to optimize your after-tax returns while simultaneously lowering your tax bill, direct indexing, all for 0.25% a year. I'm not surprised Wealthfront's grown over 20 times in the last 2 years. They now have over $2.4 billion in assets being managed. They would be managing my assets. This is the first sponsor we've ever had that I want to use and I can't because of SEC regulations. A client cannot do an endorsement. But I can tell you, I read many years ago the books by the guys who are behind this. Brilliant, like The Random Walk Down Wall Street. Have you read that? Incredible. These guys have really spent some time thinking. There it is. And Winning the Loser's Game, Charles Ellis, Burton Malkiel. These guys are really sharp. And they've created a very sophisticated investment tool that you could take advantage of for a very low cost. It's transparent. It's accessible. You could see all your accounts in one place, whether they're personal, their joint, or their retirement. And I would do all three if I were you. You could see every trade they make on your behalf. It's right there on the dashboard. Or you can use their mobile app or their desktop app. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. Sign up today. Get your free personalized investment portfolio. See what you think. And then decide how much you want to put in. You could start with as little as $500. And just for you right now, for all our listeners, if you sign up today, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 free of charge forever. Now, that's a better deal. Your first $15,000 free of charge forever. So those big-time investor, you know, charges for investment advisors, that's gone. You don't even pay Wealthfront's 0.25%. Free for life. For compliance purposes, I have to tell you, Wealthfront Incorporated is an SEC-registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are offered through Wealthfront Brokerage Corporation, member FINRA and SIPC. This is not a solicitation to buy or sell securities. Investing in securities involves risks, and there is the possibility of losing money. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Please visit Wealthfront.com to read their full disclosure. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. And now, with the market going all over the place, this is when you really want to have something like Wealthfront working on your side. We're talking to Alan Stern from his office in Boulder, Colorado. He is the principal investigator, the PI, for the amazing New Horizons. I called it a satellite, and I was spanked badly yesterday. Probe? Is that the best? Is that the right word for it?
My favorite word is spacecraft.
I like that, yeah. I don't know what the technical distinction is between a spacecraft and probe, but I do know it's not a satellite rotating around the Earth. Where is New Horizons right now?
Well, New Horizons is speeding away from the Pluto system and further into the Kuiper Belt at the rate of about 1 million kilometers or 750,000 miles a day.
Wow.
So every day breaking new ground.
That is remarkable. What are we looking for in the Kuiper Belt? Tell me what the Kuiper Belt is. I don't want to misdefine it.
Sure. The Kuiper Belt is it's the third zone of our solar system. You know, we have the innermost zone where the four rocky terrestrial planets orbit, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. Then there's the middle solar system. That's where the four giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, orbit. The Kuiper Belt, the first discovery in the Kuiper Belt was Pluto back in 1930. And but in the 1990s, we discovered that this is actually the home region for all the short-period comets, like the one that the Rosetta mission is orbiting. It came from the Kuiper Belt. There are literally billions of comets. These are icy, rocky objects that measure just a few miles across, like the size of a city or a small town. And then there are also half a dozen known small planets, none of them bigger than Pluto, but one essentially the same size, and several others that are of that cohort, just like Venus and Earth are about the same size, and Mars is only half as big as the Earth, for example. There are a group of small planets out there, and then in between the comets and the small planets are a whole range of objects, from sort of super comets to what we call planetesimals, the stuff out of which the planets were built. And all of this lies very far from the sun, billions of miles, where it's very, very cold. Because it's cold, all the chemistry is way slowed down. So in effect, the Kuiper Belt is kind of a timeless look into the past of our solar system. The objects that are there don't age very fast because they're in this deep freeze. And by going there, we can study not only this new small class of planet that we didn't even know about until the 90s, really, and we can study the building blocks for planets and try to understand the origins of our solar system. That's what the Kuiper Belt is.
That's exciting.
And I should point out, it's the largest structure in our planetary system. The Kuiper Belt is vast. It is three times larger than everything from the sun to Neptune combined.
Wow.
So it's really gargantuan, and it's hard to wrap your head around that. But New Horizons is currently speeding away from the sun, past Pluto, near the inner edge of the Kuiper Belt. And over the next about 10 years, we'll cross the entirety of the Kuiper Belt.
I've seen far too many bad science fiction TV shows and movies. I imagine this poor little New Horizons flying into a mass of floating debris and space junk. It's pretty spread out, isn't it?
That's right.
How dangerous is it out there for New Horizons?
It's not dangerous for New Horizons. I like to tell people, look, it's really empty. That is why we call it space. It's space. It's empty. Take for example, the comets of the Kuiper Belt. I said that there are billions of them, and they lie individually millions of miles apart from one another.
Yeah.
So everything in between is just emptiness. So we built New Horizons, and when we did, we calculated the probability that it would get hit by even tiny little pieces of debris, chips off rocks and things like that, in the Kuiper Belt, and actually put a bulletproof shield made of Kevlar into the thermal blankets of the spacecraft to protect us from the occasional little dings, because we're going so fast, 30,000 plus miles an hour, it could really do some damage. But the Kevlar shield protects us, and just like the Voyagers and Pioneer spacecraft that have also been this way in the past, New Horizons is just perfectly safe, and I don't lose any sleep at all worrying about that.
All right, I got a question for you from Santa Barbarian in the chat room. I don't even know what this means, so I'm going to just ask it. When will New Horizons reach the shockwave of the heliosphere, and do you expect it to be operating by that time? Will the hydrazine, I guess it's using hydrazine as a propellant, will it last that long?
Wow, that's a great set of questions. So first, for those who don't know, the heliosphere is the region of space which is filled by the sun's escaping solar wind. And that pushes outward and outward until it meets the boundary with interstellar space. And that's the shock that the questioner was asking about. The solar wind is actually moving out at supersonic speed, so it creates a real shock wave at that interface. And interestingly enough, the solar wind actually, this bubble of space called the heliosphere actually breathes outward and inward, and outward and inward with this 11-year solar cycle. So sometimes it's farther out, and sometimes it's a little closer in, but it's typically around 100 times as far from the sun as the Earth is. That's three times as far as Pluto, so it's a long way from where we are now. And it's possible that New Horizons could get that far, with the power that's on board the spacecraft. The spacecraft is powered by a plutonium-powered battery. And every year, the plutonium, which has a half-life, produces a little less electricity for us, 3 watts less every year, but that mounts up. And over time, we'll get to a point eventually in the middle or maybe in the late 2030s when we don't have enough power to run the spacecraft. Mm-hmm. And that's coincidentally just about the time we should be getting to the boundary with interstellar space. So it's kind of a horse race for us. We might make it, we might not. And part of it just depends upon the luck of whether the boundary is at that time farther out or closer in. Oh, and wow. We'll just have to wait and see. But we're going to try.
What? That was a great question. Fascinating. Is New Horizons accelerating still?
No, New Horizons is coasting. And almost all the speed that we got is due to either the rocket that launched us back in 2006 or the Jupiter gravity assist that we got back in 2007.
A little slingshot maneuver around Jupiter.
Right. So now we're coasting. And as we pull away from the sun, it actually slows us down a little bit each year. We're moving about 10% slower now than back in 2007. So, but the spacecraft is moving fast enough that it will never return. It will escape the sun's gravity and move out into the galaxy. It'll be a derelict by that point because we won't have the power to run it, as I was just saying.
Right.
But nonetheless, it's on a one-way trip, and it's headed out into the Milky Way.
Very romantic. As long as the plutonium battery holds out, will we continue to receive data? I mean, it's getting farther and farther away. Don't we get too far away to hear it?
Well, it turns out that we will run out of power before anything else. We have enough fuel to go past that point in the 2030s to point the spacecraft. We have enough reliability, we think, in the onboard systems that it should still be operating in. And in terms of telecommunications, we could operate a lot further out than where we will be in the 2030s if we only had the power to run those radios.
That's amazing. Is it? I can't get Wi-Fi from like across my house. So yeah. Is it? It's and I'm sure you don't have a 1,000-watt transmitter on New Horizons.
No, actually, it's a 15-watt transmitter.
15-watt. It must be highly directional.
It is. It's got a big dish antenna that focuses the radio waves into a narrow beam.
Wow. Amazing. We just saw a picture of Clyde Tombaugh, who in 1930 discovered Pluto. He was an amateur astronomer, later hired by the Lowell Observatory. And I think I remember that Tombaugh's family, his great-grandkids or something, were they there at...
Well, actually, his children.
His children were there.
Yeah, his children, Alden and Annette, who are both retirees, were there at the Pluto flyby. Absolutely.
Oh, man. I have to tell you... when we started seeing those amazing pictures of Pluto, it brought tears to my eyes. There is something so exciting and romantic and inspiring, probably most importantly inspiring, about this kind of work, because this is in many ways the highest achievement of human technology and science, and almost unbelievable that it could even, in our lifetime, that we could be seeing pictures that good of Pluto.
Well, Leo, thanks for saying that. You know, I can't tell you the number of people that have written on social media, written me personally or other members of our team, and said similar things. I was just in Vermont, and I gave a talk to about 1,500 people, and afterwards a line formed, and two college-age girls came up to me and said, "We just want you to know that New Horizons is the best thing that's ever happened in our lifetime, and
we're so
glad you did it." And wow, that you don't get that every day from people.
Yeah.
Talk about making you feel great that you did something that really did inspire. That did it.
So the data is getting back to us very slowly. We had actually one of your scientists on earlier, and she said that we've only received a fraction of the total information that New Horizons gathered about Pluto.
Yeah. In fact, by design, we've only sent about 5% of the data back to the Earth so far. We're going to be spending the next year sending all the rest. And we not only have 5%, but the 5% we have isn't the best stuff. All the high-resolution imagery and spectroscopy and all the most important atmospheric data sets, all of that is still waiting to come down.
Why is that? Wouldn't you want to send that first?
Well, if you really want to know, I'll tell you.
Yes. You're saving dessert for last?
So here's the story. So New Horizons is inexpensive compared to other space missions for a reason. We have a small team. And a few years ago, when we were designing the Encounter, we realized that in order to send home data throughout the later parts of July and August, we would have to be taking our attention from the Encounter and writing all the computer programs that did that during June and July. Because it takes us about 2 months to develop these command sequences. So that didn't seem like a very smart thing to me as PI, that we would take our hand off the wheel and try to be doing two things at once. I thought we should be paying attention to the Encounter at Encounter, particularly if anything went wrong.
Right.
And as you might know, something bad did go wrong, and we were able to fix it and get back on track. But fortunately, we weren't also trying to plan for the downlink, this sending home of all the data. So we stopped downlink planning for June and July so we could pay attention. And we started again right after the flyby. And by coincidence, the torrent of data that will be coming down for about a year begins this coming Saturday on September 5th. So starting next week, our science team, you and all your listeners, it's going to be raining data. It's going to be raining data for 52 weeks.
Wow. Okay, you just opened a whole can of worms. I got 800 questions now. I want to know what happened, what went wrong. I want to know why you didn't write the software before you left. There's so much, so many things. And what kind of data we're getting? What's the bandwidth? Okay, hang on. Alan Stern is our guest. Pilot, astronaut, space, wannabe astronaut, came so close. You were an alternate, right?
Yeah.
Gosh, that must... So close. Maybe if we go to Mars, we could just take you.
I'm young. There's still more time.
There's time left. I as I said, we're the same age, and I dreamed my whole childhood of being an astronaut. Never made it. But boy, I didn't get that close. Hey, at least you're getting to work on some really, really exciting stuff and changing human history in some ways. And we'll talk more about that with Dr. Stern. But first, I want to talk about, crazy this might sound, my dinner last night. I cooked a little Blue Apron. I am really loving Blue Apron. So I'll give you the quick rundown of what Blue Apron is. You go online, blueapron.com, and you set it up. They deliver fresh ingredients. Nothing's frozen. Fresh produce right out of the farm, meats, fish, to you with recipe card. And it's all perfectly proportioned. And then you cook it, and you make these amazing meals. This is the shawarma, which is one of my favorite things ever, that Jason made. There's the card stock. So you get this beautiful recipe card, pictures. There's even more online. There's videos. And you have access to that for free, by the way, if you go to blueapron.com. But the thing I love about Blue Apron is I'm always making – I don't know. I love to cook. And if you love to cook or you want to learn to cook, this is a great thing. You know, it eliminates shopping, introduces you to new stuff. If you love to cook, don't you experience this where you kind of get to the point where I'm going to make the same recipe again because I want to make something new, but I don't have time to shop for it. I don't have time to figure out what it – Blue Apron solves that. They deliver this thing to you, a kit that you're going to make a new meal of. I made a salad, a green bean. What was it? Oh, it was so good. Green bean, tomato, shallots, Kalamata olives. Lime juice salad was blew my mind. And I'm going to make it from now on because now I know. Now I know how. You get to choose your menu. You'll never get the same menu twice at blueapron.com. No trips to the grocery store. I like this too. No waste for unused ingredients. I made something called a 3-cup chicken, which is a Taiwanese favorite. And it's named 3-cup because in the old days, it'd have a cup of soy sauce, a cup of rice vinegar, and a cup of sesame oil. So when I got the recipe from Blue Apron, it had little containers with exactly, not a cup because they've modified the recipes, but just exactly the right amount. A little bit of ginger, which I minced up. A little garlic. Oh man, my mouth's watering just thinking about it. You're going to love Blue Apron, less than $10 a meal. They have meal plans for two, so it's great for date night or a couple. They also have family meal plans with kid-friendly ingredients. That's great too because you're going to introduce the kids to cooking. Which I think everybody needs to know. Every meal is balanced, 500 to 700 calories, and so yummy. You can tell my mouth is watering. Cooking takes about half an hour. I'm a little slow. Took me a little longer. Doesn't matter. You're loving it. You're enjoying it. You're learning. Shipping's free. The menus are always new. You'll never get the same meal twice. And they will work around your schedule and your dietary preferences. This week on the menu, late summer pork bolognese, chicken pod quimau, salmon burgers and aioli. I made the beef burgers and aioli last night. It was incredible. Seared steaks with romesco sauce and roasted potatoes. Oh, mushrooms and ricotta calzones. Have you ever wondered how to make a calzone? You'll learn. And then the neat thing is you'll know how to make it from now on. That's what I really love. They do the shopping for you. They give you the techniques, the tools, everything you need. They even sell kitchen implements on their site, by the way. BlueApron.com. I just found that out. Really cool. I'll tell you what. Let's do this. Let's give you your first two meals free. Now you can't say no. You don't just your first two meals are free. Just try it. Please do me a favor. BlueApron.com/twit. If you've got kids, sign up for the family plan. And your kids will go off into life with one of the best gifts you can give them, the gift of being able to cook a great meal. BlueApron.com/twit. You're watching Triangulation. Saul Alan Stern, Dr. Stern, our guest. He's a principal investigator of the New Horizons mission to Pluto. And, okay, you said you had a little trouble. I don't remember that. What went wrong?
Well, it was back on July the 4th, about 10 days before getting to Pluto. I got a phone call from the project manager, Glenn Fountain, and he said to me, Alan, we've lost communications with the spacecraft.
Oy.
Nothing like that had ever happened in 9+ years of flight.
So close. You've been flying for 9 years. You're 4 days away.
Yeah. Actually, 10 days away. Yeah, very, very close. So so it turns out our main computer had been asked to do too much, and it reset, switched to the backup, and the spacecraft was turning on all the backup systems. So we eventually, that afternoon, regained contact, and then our mission operations team had to swing into action because we were so close to Pluto. They had to do about, I think it was about a month's work in the space of 3 days. They had to get us off the backup systems onto the prime system. They had to bring the spacecraft back up to the state that it was at before we had the problem. They had to reload all the flight plan, all the instructions for the flyby, and all the associated files that went with it. Some of those have been put up on the spacecraft as far back as in December of last year. Do it all flawlessly, or we would trip again, and they got it all done. There were people camping out in the hallways, sleeping on desks.
Holy cow.
It was like in the movie Apollo 13.
And it's not like you can put the brakes on or go back or turn around and let's do that pass again. You got one shot.
They saved the day. And it worked perfectly. And the flyby was a big success, as you know.
I'm calling Dana Brunetti at Trigger Street right now. Forget that next Jason Bourne movie. This is the movie. Amazing. Part of this is a testament to the fact that you're not using consumer grade computer technology in there. I mean, this stuff is has to be robust. You can't go make a service trip.
That's right. Very high reliability parts, very careful control over software and software changes.
What's the software written in?
Well, it's actually written in machine language, so it's not. It's not a language you would know, or it's not like a C code.
Right.
Although there is C code that we can write, and then we translate it to the machine language from there.
Right.
The actual machine is running on machine level, very basic instructions.
And it's a processor. Well, it's a 9-year-old processor. Some have said it's kind of akin to the cell processor in the original PlayStation. But it's hardened, right? Because you've got cosmic rays hitting it and things. Right. You can't just... Right.
And we don't want the latest, flashiest parts on a spacecraft. We want very well-proven parts that are going to be reliable over a very long period of time.
Right.
Because once you launch New Horizons, you can't call it back for the repair shop.
So 9 years ago, you're making these decisions. Is there like a NASA catalog of parts that you just go through and say, yeah, we'll use that and that? Or is this all done purpose-built?
No, actually, in the case of the electronics, our electrical engineering team did exactly that. There are NASA-approved parts and military standard parts that we can choose from. And everything we do, from design to the selection of parts to the way that we test it when we build it, gets reviewed by external review boards so that you've got people checking and making sure we haven't overlooked anything. And the system that NASA's developed for this is so good that you almost never hear of a failure out of NASA.
I know. It's amazing.
They're very complicated things, first time, frontier, and yet we make it work again and again. That's just a credit to the agency and not just the technology, but also the processes that have been put in place so that they can make something very hard look easy.
Yeah, I think we take it for granted, you know. I mean, of course, there have been tragedies in the space program, but so few, really, compared to the risks and the challenges of what everybody at NASA is doing. It's just mind-boggling. Is there some, I mean, how did this process develop? I've never asked this question. We talked to a lot of NASA scientists before, but how did this process develop? Was there one person who said, I know how to do this and we're going to do it this way, or has it evolved over time?
It's more of an evolution. Yeah. It started off as a trial and error and good practice, and then people wrote things down, and then became, over time, and we've been doing this for decades now, mm-hmm. plenty of chance to improve it, to have review panels look at the review panels, and to have outside experts come in, and we learn from every mission. We conduct exercises on New Horizons every year after every major event called the Lessons Learned, where all the engineering and scientific specialties in the mission, even the management folks, get together in a room and say, well, we learned this, we learned that, we didn't know this would happen exactly this way. And then we take those lessons and we use them to improve the way that we operate the mission going forward. And each mission rolls that up and helps the larger community of NASA missions learn from mistakes and try to make them more and more rare. Just like in the airplane business and other businesses, it's just that this is the coolest business around.
Yeah, no kidding. Dr. Stern's doctorate is in astrophysics and planetary science, but you have a master's in aerospace engineering. So I presume that's one of the disciplines in aerospace engineering is how to do it right.
That is. When I studied aerospace engineering, my specialty was in trajectories and orbital mechanics.
Wow.
That's helped out a lot for some of the things that I've worked on space missions over the years, but I took basic courses in things like aerodynamics and airplane systems and spacecraft systems and so forth. It was all helpful.
Yeah, I bet. As my grandpa used to say, you measure twice, cut once. The planning is everything because you only get one chance. So were there any surprises as you flew by Pluto? I know that probably different disciplines had different aha moments. What were yours?
You mean about Pluto itself as opposed to...
Well, yes. Or the mission.
There were lots of surprises. I was, obviously I thought about this a lot, but actually seeing the planet and its satellites up close, I was astounded with how complicated a story Pluto has to tell us. It's clear from looking at the imagery of its geology and what its seasons are doing, what its atmosphere is doing, that it's a lot more than we bargained for, even. And we bargained for quite a bit. We're also surprised, I'm particularly surprised, that Pluto's geologically active today. We can see mm-hmm. whole regions of the planet, like the one that we informally call Sputnik Planum. It's the size of Texas. It's an ice field the size of Texas. And we can't find any craters on it, which means it must be very recently created, because out there in the Kuiper Belt, things are falling on Pluto all the time. And when you see absolutely no craters, you can actually estimate an age. And what we come up with is something less than 1 or 2% of the age of the solar system. So Pluto must be active after all these billions of years. We're not sure how it does that. And it has great implications for understanding the workings of other planets, because it's telling us that there's something about the energy budget in small planets that we don't understand that causes them to last longer and to be energetic very, very far after they were formed. 4+ billion years in Pluto's case. And I think it's going to take a while to sort that out. It's a real mystery.
Yeah, one of the first things I saw. My dad's a geologist, so I thought, I actually noticed that. I said, why is that so smooth? And we asked Jill when she was on the show about that. She explained that. And that is amazing. You think of this distant, you know, this Kuiper Belt and these distant objects as being just dead, and they're not.
No, we know Pluto's got active weather, seasons, and now active geology. And when we get the higher resolution images, I bet we'll be surprised a bunch more because we'll be able to see so much better. So fasten your seatbelt.
You said that Saturday we're going to start seeing that.
Starting this coming week. That's right. Then it'll go on for about a year.
Oh, man. Well, what is the bandwidth? How fast is that data coming to us?
Well, not very fast by modern communication standards, but we are communicating from 3 billion miles away with a 15-watt transmitter.
Yeah.
So we communicate the highest rates we ever use at this distance from the sun are 4,500 bits per second or so, which is like dial-up modem rates.
Right.
But the technology to do that and to be able to hear those bits coming back across billions of miles of space is just phenomenal.
You just a couple of days ago, you selected the next destination for New Horizons in the Kuiper Belt. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we sat down with NASA just last week and agreed that the next flyby that New Horizons it'll be possible for us to undertake will be a flyby of one of these planetesimals that I spoke about earlier, the building blocks of small planets like Pluto.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have a real name yet. It's just got a designator called 2014 MU69. That's just a license plate. It was found in 2014 by the Hubble Space Telescope. It's about 40 or 50 kilometers across. So it's not like Pluto. It's not a big round world. It's a small building block of those worlds, but an ancient sample of the material out of which Pluto and these other small planets were formed. And we have to write a proposal to NASA for the funding, which we'll do next year, and NASA will have it graded by outside experts. And if it ranks highly enough, we'll get funded to fly this mission. But now we pick the target. In October, we're going to fire the engines to get us on course because we can't really wait. It'll cost too much fuel. If we waited a year, we wouldn't be able to carry it out. And if all that happens the way I hope it will, NASA will announce approval some point later next year, and we will arrive at this distant target another billion miles away on, of all dates, January 1st, 2019.
So wow. So you answered kind of in a way my question or my proposed question, which is this is why you're doing your programming as you fly. You don't know what you're going to pick to see next or where you're going to be next. So the software has to be sent. Is it being sent to New Horizons constantly? Or?
Well, we have a certain amount of memory on board, so we can only afford to send up a certain number of instructions.
Holy
fill the memory. Typically, we can send up a list that'll keep the spacecraft busy for between 2 and 4 weeks at a time. So every few weeks, we're sending up another set of instructions called a command load.
Wow. How long does it take to get to New Horizons at this point?
Well, we send it at the speed of light on radio waves from the Earth. And so it arrives, currently, it's about 4.5 hours from when we send it until it gets up on board the bird.
At the speed of light, 4.5 hours. Wow. Is the upstream at the same rate roughly as the downstream?
And when we send data back, like the images or spectra, they're coming down at the speed of light, and they take 4.5 hours. Wow. Next year, it'll be 5.5 hours.
Yeah.
So year after, it'll be 6.5 hours each way.
What will be the is this moment when we kind of run out of power on these plutonium batteries? How far out is that?
Well, we should be about 90 and 100 times as far from the sun as the Earth is, about triple our current distance.
And when will that be, do you know?
In the mid or late 2030s.
Wow.
It really is going to depend upon how good the engineers who are working on the project, if it's still funded then, are at power management, whether they can find some tricks and save some more watts and let it operate a few extra years. The guys and women on Voyager have done exactly that time after time. And they now expect the Voyagers to be operating almost 50 years after they were launched.
That's amazing.
So we'll see what what our mission operations team in the 2030s can come up with. We haven't even hired those people out there.
No, they're kids in grade school right now who'll be the scientists will be working on that data.
Sure.
But that, you know, you talk about all the perils of the mission, the distance, the harsh conditions. But one of the perils is lack of funding. You mean that this could get defunded, that we could have something out there that's still communicating 30 years hence, and nobody put any money towards it?
Yeah, that's right.
That's shocking.
Well, you have to think about it a little different way. NASA has a certain amount of money, and you want to use it as effectively as possible. So all the missions that have finished their primary goal, in our case, getting to Pluto, collecting the data, and then over the next year, sending it back, all the missions that are in after their prime have to go through a routine review process to make sure that they're still productive and worth the money that it costs. Otherwise, you'd end up with some duds continuing at the expense of other missions you could be starting to do new things. So this is a normal, and I think it's a really smart process that the agency has. And we're a team player, just like all the other missions. So we have to go through it to get our extended mission approved. And after the Kuiper Belt flyby, if that one gets approved, we'll have to propose to do more things. And if it doesn't, if it's not right side up, if what we're proposing isn't worth the money, then I think the agency should turn it off.
Well, I guess that's life. I just feel like, golly, have you ever thought of Kickstartering? A little crowdfunding? It'd be a shame to cut get so, you know, so far out there and to cut the cord. And I bet is that not possible? I know we just talked to somebody from Smithsonian. We were talking about how they crowdfunded restoring Neil Armstrong's spacesuit.
I saw that.
Yeah, for the Air and Space Museum. Has that been ever considered by NASA? Because I think there's a lot of people out here who would be very glad to kick in a little bit, keep something like New Horizons flying.
Well, I don't know that NASA can collect money other than the Department of the Treasury.
Well, write your Congress critter and get more money for NASA. That's one thing for sure.
I'm with you.
Yeah, no question about that. But there is, and you've been involved in this, there is also the private sector. How does that work with the public sector funding? NASA is obviously a public sector project.
Well, Leo, there's all kinds of private companies that work on spaceflight. They're the companies that build things, build the rockets and build the spacecraft and build the ground systems. There are space tourism companies that are now coming along. And I know you probably talked about them on this show. They're companies that do commercial remote sensing, commercial communications, communication satellites.
And asteroid harvesting,
No, it's all part of the future.
Yeah.
It's pretty exciting.
And so hand in hand, these two can work hand in hand.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't think we could have one without the other.
Right.
In either case.
Right. I feel like if you had, I don't know, this is 2030, who knows what'll happen, but if you had something like New Horizons out there and NASA decided, well, we're not going to get anything really valuable out of this. We don't want to fund it. We have other more interesting projects, better money's better spent. If there were some way to kind of open source it, give it to the community, I bet you there's people out there who would code, who would do whatever was keep the radios working, whatever was necessary, just as a great project. You know,
I don't doubt you at all.
Yeah.
Hey, and thank you for having me on. I really, really appreciate the invitation to be on today, and I had a great time.
Spread the word. Alan, I thank you so much for your time. I just find this all fascinating. We wish you the best. How long are you going to stay on the project?
Hey, Leo, I'm going to stay on as long as they'll let me.
All right, right on. Alan Stern, principal investigator of New Horizons. Very exciting stuff. Keep up the good work. We'll look forward to the new data coming soon.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Our show today brought to you by, I got to tell you about my Ring doorbell. Did you see the news? It was on KTLA over the weekend. The news about the Ring doorbell? Guy's house got burglarized. He had installed a Ring doorbell. There's pictures of the guy. Did they catch him yet? I don't know. This thing is amazing. It's got, think of it as a think of it as a caller ID for your house, the Ring doorbell. You've heard me talk about this. And boy, it is now a bigger success story than ever before. In fact, the news keeps getting better and better about Ring. Last week, we told you that Richard Branson has just become a major investor in Ring because he believes in what it's doing. Ring is fascinating. The idea is this. In fact, we have a Ring doorbell at our house. It's very easy to install. You take your old doorbell off. In most cases, you'll have two wires that you can easily hook up the Ring, take you 15, 20 minutes. They give you all the tools you need in the box to do this, including a level. And now your doorbell rings just like before, but there's a little bit of a difference. It doesn't just ring in the house. It rings on your iOS or your Android device. It rings wherever you are in the world over the internet. It lets you know that somebody is ringing your doorbell. It has motion detection, too. You can go onto your device and answer that. There it is. Say, yeah, what do you want? I'm in the tub. Or, yeah, leave the package at the door. And the motion detection is great, too, because I always know when somebody's coming in the house visiting. My doorbell goes off all the time, and I love it. I love it. See who's there from anywhere. We get a special deal, $10 off the normal price. You'll get it for $189. You can totally install it yourself. You'll see there's a bad guy. You can tell he looks like a bad guy. There's a good guy. There's the delivery guy. You can the Time Magazine named one of their top 10 gadgets last year. Let me see. I want to find this KTLA story because it was just wild. It is a great – it is a security camera. It is peace of mind. It is convenience. It is Ring. Ring doorbell. Now, I want you to go to ring.com/triangulation to get your deal, your deal on Ring, $10 off. Yes, they it was a home invasion. Let me see. Let me find the story here. This is I think they got the guy. Anyway, I love it. ring.com/triangulation. If you don't have a hardwired doorbell, by the way, it can also be battery powered. It's got lithium ion batteries that will last a year and a little USB port on it. So you can charge it up and have it go another year. So you can put a doorbell in places where there no doorbell exists for total convenience, for peace of mind, for caller ID for your home. ring.com/triangulation. Love this thing. The Ring. Candy Graham. Hey, I had a lot of fun talking to Dr. Stern, and I hope you did too. It is exciting to hear what NASA is up to and how just a mind-bogglingly brilliant these engineers are. And the thought and effort that is put into this is just incredible. But that's one of the things I love about triangulation. Each week we've got somebody who's going to inspire you, who's going to inform. We're going to learn and get excited about this amazing world of technology we live in. I hope you'll join me next week, each and every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific. That's 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC, on twit.tv/live. And after the fact, twit.tv/TRI. You can get audio and video. We also are everywhere your podcasts are. So thank you for joining us, Dr. Stern. Thank you for watching, and I'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.